So, Carl, and we were talking outside, but this is your first Comic-Con in 13 years?
14 years, that's right.
14 years.
I still think of San Diego as a place to come down and find interesting zines, so I'm kind of out of date. But that's because I usually go to the Japanese shows, you know, Anime Expo. I'll be at Otakon in a few weeks. So, I'm the only person at Dark Horse who only does manga. There are various editors at Dark Horse who do both original comics and manga, but I just specialize in the Japanese comics.
There you go. Hey. Sorry, I'm late. Came in wearing sunglasses. I did. It was bright out.
In case you haven't heard, this is Chris Witcher.
Hi.
He's the director of the Toronto Comic Art Festival, and he's a new employee of Viz Media. Please tell the world.
Wow.
What exactly are you going to be doing at Viz?
I'm actually an employee with, rather than for, Viz Media, to be clear. So I founded the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, which is a comics festival that's focused on independent, creator-owned, creator-directed comics and graphic novels. And I've been a comic book retailer for 20-something years. And I'm working with Viz now as an editor-at-large, which means I'll be traveling between here in North America. I live in Toronto. I'll be going to San Francisco, going to shows like this, but also going to Tokyo 4 or 5 times a year just to see what's sort of happening in comics and manga there and see what great stuff is being missed and that we can maybe bring over and do some cool stuff with that here. So I didn't have this job before Deb asked me to be on the panel, so I apologize that there's 2 people from Viz here. I didn't mean to do that. I was just here for TCAP.
That's okay.
Yeah. I'm sure it's fine. But I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
But unlike the Andy Nakatani, he's here from Shonen Jump.
Yay!
And you just announced a couple of things at the Shonen Jump panel, yes?
Yeah, one of our, the announcement that we announced at the Shonen Jump panel is, we have a free section on the website, so we post free manga on the website and in our apps, and starting August 7th, we're going to start putting up a new spin-off of My Hero Academia called My Hero Academia Vigilantes. Mm. So that's going to be pretty cool.
We'll talk a little bit about this at the panel, too.
Okay. Yeah.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
And David.
Oh, I'm the last one left. So my name is David Brothers. I'm branding manager at Image Comics, and mostly I just like reading manga and talking about it, so I tricked Devin into letting me on the panel.
David is way too modest. David has actually you probably do the best shelf talkers of manga ever out of anyone I've known. Like you can sell me on something and be like, it's lame. And then David chats it up and like, ooh, I'll check that out.
Yeah, if anyone here is unfortunate enough to follow me on Twitter, pretty much I only tweet about manga and rap music, so.
Which is it's a bigger Venn diagram than you think.
Yeah.
Anyway, since this was kind of a pre-show, because I figured we were all sitting down, and it was fine, and we would just chat how we normally would chat before getting started. But Bridget Albertson, who is joining us, she is dashing from probably the other side of the convention center. Mm-hmm. So we are going to start without her for now, okay? Let's go. Recording. Hi, everybody. My name is Deb Aoki. I write for Publishers Weekly and Anime News Network. And today, this year, we're doing something a little bit different. We're going to be talking a little bit about superheroes in Japanese pop culture and in American pop culture and how they both reflect society, Japanese society, American society, how they borrow from each other, and just things that we think are unique to either or. I guess this is kind of going to be a pretty freewheeling conversation. I don't really have much of an agenda. I just trusted that these were very smart and interesting people that if you sat next to them at a restaurant and heard them talking, you would want to eavesdrop too.
You'd have to be moved, actually. You'd be like, I'm tired of these people talking about manga.
So I'm just going to do like a little quickie little slideshow, kind of some of the things that I thought was interesting about manga superheroes. For example, remember, Japanese comics and American comics have been borrowing from each other for quite a long time. It's well known that Osamu Tezuka was heavily influenced by Disney, for example. This is the Astro Boy omnibus that Dark Horse Comics is putting out, and I suggest you pick it up. Carl, would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, of course, Astro Boy, I believe it originally came out in 1953 in Japan, shortly after the occupation period ended, which sort of, in a way, was the closure of the war. And Astro Boy represented, in some ways, the optimism that people had to build a new Japan. The idea, he was atomic-powered, and being atomic-powered in a country only 7 years after nuclear bombs were dropped there may seem like a strange statement, but it was the idea that in the future we're going to use science and technology to advance. It also dealt with many social issues and talked about issues of prejudice in a way that was suitable for children. But one of its tremendous influences is also, I think, encouraging the idea that robots were your friends. Very different from the Terminator tradition you might see in the U.S. But I honestly think this is an example where the strength of fiction, in this case science fiction manga, actually had a long-term influence on people's cultural values. You know, by putting across this idea, educating children in such a strong way. And of course, Astro Boy is a superpowered being. Marvel, of course, has superpowered androids, I guess, like the Vision and all that. So in a sense, he is a very good starting point for talking about the superhero comparison.
Even before Astro Boy, too, you look at the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, and he's just beating up on robots. Like
another left.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems to go back so far, this idea of like North Americans being terrified of our robot future and Japan sort of welcoming it. And I think that really plays, I think that'll echo down all of our discussions about superheroism between the two countries.
Not to get too essentialist, but one explanation you often hear, and sometimes hear Japanese people say about that, is it's the influence of the Shinto concept of kami, the idea that inanimate objects, you know, can have spirit, and that inanimate objects can be revered. In other words, perhaps there's this idea in the West that there's something unholy or inherently evil about a lifeless object that gets up and moves around and talks, whereas perhaps that isn't necessarily so obvious in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to check in?
What's that?
You look like you want to jump in.
No, okay. I'll jump in
one of them. Yeah. Okay. I'll move on. Another highly influential Japanese manga is Momo for the Cub. It's pretty well known that Frank Miller's art style is very much influenced by this work. If you haven't already picked up this series from Dark Horse, I highly suggest you do it. It's required reading if you love manga.
Deb, could you let us repeat again who the publisher of that is?
Dark Horse Manga. What booth are they in, Carl?
It's a really big one. and I want to note, Gombos likes to point this out, but The Wolf and Cub is not just one of our best-selling manga, it's one of our best-selling titles, period. So, it would be fair to say that it is, like Astro Boy, that it is one of the great classics in the pantheon, in the canon, as it were, of manga. It's one of those titles that, when there's some Japanese tourist coming into town who's like retired and elderly, if I mention that we're doing that, at least he's heard of it.
Yeah. All right. There's also Go Ranger and Power Rangers, of course. What I find, I show this slide of the Power Rangers when I give a talk on the power of color in user experience design. I said the red is always the lead, the blue is always the cool guy, the green is the young guy, the yellow guy likes to eat, and the pink is always the chick. Over and over and over again. I don't know. It's kind of cool. And then, of course, a lot of those. And then, what I found interesting about the Japanese version of superheroes is that they'll have a concept, and then there'll be new generations of that same concept for the next.
Thank you so much.
The next bunch, and the next bunch. So there's been variations on Power Rangers for years, and some of them have come to America and become beloved as well. Cyborg 009 by Shotaro Ishinomori, as a lot of people consider Jack Kirby to be the father of. Superhero comics in America, I would say Shotaro Ishinomori.
At least is equal, honestly. These are like two of my favorite things. I discovered Cyborg 009 as a kid when it was running on Adult Swim. And like I latched onto it because it's such a cool idea.
It was on Adult Swim?
Toonami. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Can you explain the plot a little bit?
So there are nine cyborgs who were kidnapped by this organization called the Black Ghosts, depending on which translation you're reading. And they were made into superpowered robots, essentially. They each have one specialty. One guy is really good at swimming. Of course, the lady is like really good at communication. Like it's very basic, but the way they use their powers is really interesting. The baby is like the Professor X of the group. And like that sounds so goofy, but it's about the horrors of war on humanity. Like, they were made to fight in a war they never asked for. And they rebel. They're like, no, we're going to be heroes. Like, we're going to stop what you're doing. So it's a commentary on, like, war profiteering, the military-industrial complex, and also, like, accepting who you are for what you are, and then understanding your gifts and using them to better someone else's life. Mm. So even though, you know, the lady is really good at talking to people, she's still, like, that's a crucial skill. Like, you really need that in your life. If you're bad at communicating, then you're not going to get anywhere. So it's got layers for a kid's comic.
Yeah. It's actually also interesting because it's a multicultural group.
Oh, yeah. Originally, there's a black guy on there. He was drawn in a much more minstrel-y way. Like, it was kind of offensive, but it was just sort of, as time went on, he got less and less offensive as, like, the creator learned about African culture and, like, black people in general. Because what he wanted to do was make a multicultural team that was truly multicultural. There's a guy named United Kingdom, or Great Britain on the team, who's from the UK. Like, there's a French dancer, there's a guy straight out of the West Side Story. Like, his introduction is, like, the snapping gang fight scene. And it's all, like, this is the whole world. And the moral of the story is, like, war screws over everybody. And we just need to move away from that kind of paradigm. Mm.
If you'd like to read the original Cyborg 009 manga, it is available from Comixology. It's only a digital release. There are several titles like Shotaro Ishinomori. Kamen Rider is also one of his creations. There are many, many Kamen Riders. Would someone care to explain the Kamen Rider phenomenon for us?
I'm not super up on Kamen Rider. Cool, Matt.
Andy, you want to give it a
yeah,
shot?
Yeah, I'm not actually like a super Kamen Rider guy.
No, it's funny. I think this speaks to the fact that like Kamen Rider, people know about him, but he hasn't really made a splash in the U.S. yet.
It's one of the biggest franchises in Japan.
Yeah. So huge.
It's like if Superman had like one issue in France, and it was like, what's Superman? Like, we're all about Batman here.
But it's like if Superman, like every season there was a new Superman.
Yeah.
Like now there's Superman short hair.
Sort of like one with a mullet.
Superman yeah. with a mullet. Superman with the long hair. Superman with the black outfit. Superman who's Chinese. But you know, Kamen Rider has been doing this every year for the last, I'd say, 40 years.
Yeah.
it's a guy with a mask and a motorcycle. I don't know the rest of it because I haven't watched it in years.
Sometimes he punches or kicks dudes.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. There's also a Kamen Rider manga from on Comixology as well. I'm not up on Kamen Rider. I watched it when I was a kid in Hawaii. But I just like, ooh, motorcycle. Henshin, you know? It's like, ooh, exciting.
And all the fights are in gravel pits.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is a little interesting artifact that David dug up.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
So this is, there's an Incredible Hulk manga from November 1970 to maybe March 71, which is up for like one Tankobon, by Kazuo Koike, who wrote Bone Wolf and Cub, and an artist, I think Yoshihiro Mifuji. And it was just straight up the story of Bruce Banner, but set in a Japanese context. Like, you see, like, the Rick Jones, where he goes, like, to rescue Rick Jones. Like, they hit all the Incredible Hulk notes, but it's just a completely different story with a completely different cast. And one thing that's, I discovered this online in like 2008 or 2009, something like that. And someone pointed out that a lot of the panels from this manga are ripped off from Hulk comics around the same time. So there's like definite like cultural fusion going on. Where if you can swipe her print, you're like, why not? But I love the shot of Hulk in the tanks. Like, that's so good. And all the sound effects were in, or a lot of the sound effects were in English like that, like lettered American style.
Did you know that, one of the recent Japanese editions of Bone Wolf and Cub, they not only used Frank Miller's covers on the Japanese editions,
whoa.
They even added sound effects to make it look more comic-y. Sound effects that Miller didn't put in.
Yeah, I want to see that. That's
so
amazing.
He's like, you know, he's slicing into all these, Tokugawa guys, you know, and there's, squash, you know.
Really? Why was that cheap? Why did they do that? That seems really different.
I think they wanted to play up the fact that one of the most famous American comics creators liked Wolf and Cub. But it was interesting they went the extra mile and actually added sound effects that Miller himself didn't use. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I was actually, on that note, I was actually, Minofsky was tweeting about actually your panel yesterday, and he found out that Shigeru Miyazaki did Plastic Man, and he also did like a Superman comic or something like that in early Kitaro stuff. He did like Superman stories. So I think that's kind of crazy to me that he was reading superhero books.
Were these licensed editions?
It doesn't look like it. It looks, I mean, licensed.
Jiro Kuwata of and, Batman manga.
And the Jiro Kuwata Batman manga,
which is released by DC, and that's available now. And then there's a manga Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. I think somebody once found a new Mezu swipe from a 50 CC horror comic.
Ooh. Oh, yeah, and Mizuki, too.
Yeah.
So it's everyone really was clear sweeping that, you know, that these comic communities did not exist in a vacuum. Mm-hmm.
Were these all around the same time, too? Like Ikegami, Spider-Man? And
yeah, I think this came before Spider-Man. Like, Spider-Man was the hit. This is the one they don't talk about anymore.
But the Spider-Man was authorized, right?
Yeah.
But what about the Hulk one?
It was as well.
Okay. That's fascinating. I had never heard of the Hulk one.
Yeah.
So, Andy, because you work with Shonen Jump, and Shonen Jump is the preeminent, you know, manga for young boys in Japan. I noticed there's been some effort in the recent years to introduce Japanese readers to Iron Man and the Avengers and things like that.
I think, like, this generation of Japanese manga artists that are on Shonen Jump, they're more and more influenced by superhero comics. Mm. And I think a lot of it is actually not necessarily the comics, but the movies. Because just like the movies is going to be kind of like this dominant part of culture globally, right? And so they're, of course, kind of influenced by that. And I think that's their kind of gateway into comics. Of course, there are legitimate manga artists who legitimately are into the comics themselves.
I've seen really wonderful Spider-Man art by Yusuke Murata, who does wonderful.
Yeah.
They hired him to do covers.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, Marvel did, I think, pretty recently.
That guy, he's amazing.
Also, Katsuya Tarada was doing Iron Man covers for a while.
Damn.
That's right, he did an Avengers cover for Brutus Maxi.
Yeah.
I think Murata also recently did a Power Rangers, the Go Ranger poster, which is pretty cool.
He can draw anything.
So. Yeah.
I'll get to Bridget! Yeah. Everyone give her a hand!
One of the things I've been lucky enough to do, just as Bridget comes to the stage, for the last couple of years, is go to an event called Kagai Manga Fest, or International Comic Festival, in Tokyo. And every year they try to pair up French or, you know, bande dessinée authors with North American superhero comic authors with Japanese authors. So I've gotten to see some really good cultural exchange where Yusuke Murata, who does One Punch Man, actually did a, like, Batman drawing for Jim Lee, and Jim Lee did a One Punch Man drawing for Murata, and they, like, kind of exchanged it, and they drew it on stage together. So there really is a more concerted effort, especially among the Japanese publishers of translated superhero work, translated into Japanese, to try and, you know, create those connections. The sales aren't there, frankly, in Japan yet, but they, I think, are going to influence a whole generation of people that are going to maybe be more, it's going to be more aware or more relevant in the next generation. Also, hi, Bridget.
Please, Bridget, introduce yourself.
Hi, sorry. I'm Bridget Alberson. I have been reading manga since 2005 because of kids' work. I'm the editor of Manga Blog, which is kind of defunct now. I write about manga for the Barnes & Noble Sci-Fi Fantasy Blog, and I write about comics in general for School Library Journal, CBR, Smash Pages, and Publishers Weekly.
She forgot to mention she has exquisite taste in manga.
All right, let's take a look at that. Okay, so there's a lot of, there's some reboots, like this is Gatchaman, which is recently being rebooted as a comic called Infinity Force, which is a group, it's basically like four Tatsunoko anime heroes all together. This is available at the Udon booth, by the way. It's really fun. Gatchaman is kind of hot. Nothing else.
What was Gatchaman localized as earlier?
Battle of the Planets.
Battle of the Planets, right, yeah.
Thank you. Sure.
It was also called G-Force. So.
Yeah, there are several names. If you like, have you seen that Dream Daddy game, anybody? On Twitter? Yeah, so if you like dads, he's like the cool dad.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned Jim Lee. At one point in the 90s, there was Eat Man, which was
actual
Jim Lee covers. There have been attempts here and there to market manga through cover art by Americans. Arthur Adams, I believe, did Appleseed covers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true because for a very long time, as we've said, artists are often more cognizant of what other artists are doing than necessarily the market is. Mm. You know, Jeff Darrow is the great example of someone who really loves manga and is tremendously influenced by that.
Like, Image Comics wouldn't have happened without Masamune Shirow and Appleseed. Like, Liefeld, Jim Lee, and a couple other guys were huge fans of that work.
Yes, you can really
see it. So, Infinity Force is currently serialized in a magazine called Heroes, which is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, and is it the only magazine, comics magazine in Japan dedicated to superheroes?
I think it's not necessarily completely Heroes in there. I think there's like a pirate one in there as well.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Ultraman is also featured in there. You want to talk a little bit about that, Andy?
Yeah, we started putting up Ultraman. It's like a kind of a reboot of Ultraman. The art is pretty badass. Volume 1 cover is amazing, and the chapter 1, when it was in the magazine, the color page is just... It just blew me away when I looked at
it. Can you share the story a little bit?
What's that?
Can you share what the story's about?
It's basically the Ultraman story. it's a slightly different take on it.
So, like, his Ultraman grew up, and his son becomes the Ultraman.
Well, and Ultraman is what is also another franchise that kind of reinvents itself every season with like the new, I don't know, the new Ultra brother, I guess.
Yeah.
It's really, really good, actually. It's if you like superheroes and you really like digging deep, I don't know. This is one of the things about Japanese superheroes I really like is that they look at North American, like Japanese superhero creators, tokusatsu creators or whatever, look at it and just pull the stuff that speaks to them and maybe like leave everything else behind. So the baggage of a lot of North American superhero comics is kind of not, they're not really interested in it, or they're super interested in it and they want to dig down. So it's like this guy was like possessed by an alien, became Ultraman, defended the Earth for a bunch of years, and then the Ultraman spirit left him, and that was fine, except it never really left him, and his kid was, like, born as, like, a half-Ultraman, and you're like... So you've got, like, generational, like, superheroism, which is really exciting. You've got all the, like, flashy fight scenes and things and the really good character design, but you've also got these, like, actually, you're the only superhuman on Earth, and you're going to pollute the Earth and, like, ruin it, and we're coming to murder you so that we can save the Earth, and you don't, not sure who your side you're on. It's really, really good stuff. And it's because you get to, like, pull that out. Here, Academia does that, too, where it's just, like, I mean, I don't want to spoil Academia, but...
I spoke to the creators of Ultraman right around the time it started coming out in English, and you know,
I guess here at Comic Con, I think
was it? I think it was here that I did it. Yeah, I guess they all blend together after
that.
Sorry?
2 years ago. Or
2 years. So 2 years. That would be 2 years ago. Thank you. One of the things I asked him is like, how is your? I asked specifically the question of this panel: how is your superhero different from American superhero? And what they said to me was, well, we're writing for teen boys. We're writing in Shonen Jump, or is it Ultra Jump? It's not Shonen Jump, is it?
It's in that Heroes.
Okay. Anyway, but they said, our audience is teenage boys. So we're writing for their concerns. You know, we're like, what are you thinking about when you're a teenager? It's like, am I good enough? You know, what does everybody think of me? Is this stupid? And like, you hate your parents? And kind of all the teenage stuff is in there. And that's actually kind of profound, because I think... with the possible exception of Peter Parker and definitely Ms. Marvel, American superheroes are not really in that place anymore.
They're old. They're like dads. They're all bad. That's super dads.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what I like about Ultraman is that it's kind of like, what if Peter Parker was Iron Man? Like, he gets the new costume, and he's trying to do his best, but like, he might not make it. And that's part of the fun of the series.
Ultraman, I should say, was a tremendous influence on the Evangelion anime series. The entire style of combat that you see in Evangelion, the idea of giants scaring off hand-to-hand against really strange creatures, that's totally Ultraman. Mm. Even the idea of it having a 5-minute time limit on fighting is crabbed, you know, from Ultraman as well.
That was something that we talked about earlier, right? That this America, that the Japanese heroes have limits. You know, like, Ultraman can only be super for a certain amount of time.
Right.
A Superman can be super all the time unless some kryptonite comes along.
Right. I think, and like in My Hero Academia too, like everybody has these weirdly specific superpowers. They're either time limited or they can only do one thing. So I was talking to Rich Johnson, right before the DC Rich Johnson, and right before I came up here and I mentioned this, and we were talking about Ultraman and the time limit, and he said, well, when you think about it, you think about Japanese culture, like people are very, like the salary men, like you're very corporate, and then for a short period of time you go out and you get really blind drunk. And you kind of let it all go, and then your time's up, and you're back in the office and everything is great. And so I thought, maybe. It's like in a way, you're allowed to let go for a finite period of time, and then it reverts.
It's like a blood alcohol
limit. Blood alcohol limit, yeah.
It's like a great writing tool to come up with ideas, though, right? Because you have these limitations, and it's how is this character going to work around that to overcome what he needs to do.
Do you want to chime in with something?
Was there an American TV show based on Ultraman?
The Japanese show was translated.
Yeah. It was the Japanese?
Yeah.
With
you can
a
buy it on
guy
DVD.
In a silver suit.
Yeah. The Science Space Patrol?
Well, Ultra 7?
No, the one after Ultra 7.
Oh, okay.
Like the proper Ultraman.
That's right, it was transferred.
Yeah.
I think Ultraman is actually the largest franchise in terms of spin-offs and everything, like, in entertainment. It's huge.
If you go to Tokyo Station, there's an Ultraman store, and it's all Ultraman stuff. Mm. You can even buy your own Ultraman golf bag. I have a picture of it, it's spectacular. But I want to get a picture of someone who buys.
That's true.
One of the things I really liked, going back to how everyone's powers in Academia, My Hero Academia, which is out now from Viz, not from whoever the hell is scanlating on the line, that everyone's got their quirk and it's really specific. But I find that the creator is so creative because he's finding all these like crazy like iterations on what you could do with that one power. Whereas like. I don't know, I'm a long-time X-Men fan, and they didn't realize that Bobby Drake literally turns into ice so he could change his shape until, like, issue 340. It was in the first issue. It had been, like, 35 years, and they're like, well, if he saw all ice, couldn't he be a shape other than a man? And then it was just like, oh, shit. And then I'm like, redefine the character. And this guy, in the, like, first volume, he's like, okay, I'm going to do this thing, but then I'm going to do this crazy iteration of the same tiny power that you would never think of. And that's, to me, awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
So I love My Hero Academia. It's like the New Mutants comic I never got as a kid. And my favorite is Bakugo, because he's the best, obviously.
He is. I do not care for Bakugo.
And so his power is explosive sweat that he harnesses to make explosions. There's also an X-Man with that same power, but they're used completely differently. The X-Men, was it Mr. Sensitive on Ecstatic?
Oh my god, right back in the day. Yeah, yeah.
Peter Milligan and Mike Allred. And it's cool to see the same idea done in
completely
different
ways. You wouldn't think there'd be two different ways to use that idea.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, this is one of the pages I sent Deb. On the left, like, this fight scene, I just love it. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, that was really good.
Because you think, like, he's the headstrong guy. He's just going to go, like, right in the front door and knock this guy out. And then he dodges and does something else. And the grenade gauntlets is probably the coolest visual.
Yeah, I love that Japanese artists will take something that, like, yeah, both of your gloves are going to be giant grenades, and then make it work visually so that it's actually cool rather than cheesy.
Yeah.
So good.
An aesthetic difference I like, and I see this in Cardcaptor Sakura, of all places, one of the differences between American superheroes and shoujo manga, is there seems to be this idea that you have to very strongly associate a hero with a particular outfit, and they've got to wear this outfit all the time, because that's their branding. Cardcaptor Sakura, she has a kind of Alfred, you know, named Tomoyo, who's her best friend. And Tomoyo is always making her a different outfit every single time she goes out to fight. And what they do is they make different figurines and merchandise for every single outfit. So imagine if Batman had 50 different outfits and they sold you figures of all of them. And well, why not? And there's this idea, your powers are the same. You know, you wouldn't dress the same in ordinary life. Why should you dress the same when you fight evil? Mm-hmm. So... Or misunderstood cards, not, you know.
It'll segue back to our little history here.
Oh, yeah.
Magical girl.
Yes.
And there are somehow lots of magical girls.
I was just going to mention there's another called Agents of the Realm. It's a webcomic. I think it's agentsoftherealm.com. Google that. It's by this lady. Like, she just does straight up magical girls in college, and it's fantastic. Art's amazing. But yeah, Bridget.
How come I'm doing the magical girls one here? Because you,
I've talked too much already.
Oh, yeah. That's it. It's not because I'm a girl, it's because I'm magical. You know, I think that magical girls, thinking of magical girls as superheroes, is kind of a modern thing. I think when I was growing up, I was born in 1960, and I grew up reading superhero comics, but always knowing that I was reading the boys' comics. And I used to read girls' comics because I spent part of my childhood in the UK, and they have girls' comics. And I think when I discovered Sailor Moon, which was, you know, about 15 years ago, and I have two daughters, I was like, oh, look, here's a girls' comic for them. And they really embraced it in a way that I would never have believed. A magical girl. When you think about a magical girl, basically, they have an origin story, they have a mission, they have a transformation, they have special clothing that they wear. And is there a kryptonite for the magical girls? That's the only thing I'm not 100%.
Boys.
Love. Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Ain't that the truth?
as it is for all of us. And what has impressed me in recent years is the extent to which magical girls have been embraced Deb and I went to SPX 2 years ago.
Small Press Expo.
Oh, sorry, Small Press Expo. Yeah, which is like one of these little hippie comic festivals. And they had a whole panel of Magical Girl superhero creators, Magical Girl creators. It's a very grassroots thing. You see a lot of webcomics and zines and different takes of magical boys, and there are magical boys who dress as girls, and there's, all kinds of...
girl gangs, too.
Yeah.
Magical girl gangs.
Yeah.
It's a very, it's
magic
a very
switch
diverse
blades.
Group of people, actually.
It's good.
Yeah.
There's one on Sparkly, right? Maho Shoujo Chimaka, who's about a magical girl who loses her powers and becomes, when she gets older, and then she has to rediscover her powers again.
That's kind of like the rest of us, too, isn't it? Yeah. Control top and lost my powers. I think that in the same way, in a way that a superhero speaks to boys, the standard male superhero speaks to boys, that magical girls are really something for girls. Just because life is boring. I mean, I remember sitting at my desk in school going, gee, I wish the doors would explode open and that someone would be a secret agent or something. And so, I think it's great fantasy, kind of almost wish fulfillment sort of stuff.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask up at you guys. Did you think Sailor Moon would have made such a hit in this time, in the past few years, that it did?
I did, and I can document it with my blog from, 1997. Yeah. I was right there on that one.
Well, the Canadians were really strong supporters of the
Yeah, we had Sailor Moon on TV all the time, so I was the first person who was really excited that there would be, first the mix scene, which was a little bit weird, but the comic books especially were so important, and we sold them hand over fist, and then those $10 trades came out, and it was just I was a retailer at a mall store, so we would have like a pretty good gender parity of people walking through the door, but there was nothing to sell women, there just wasn't anything to sell women in 1996, 1997, 1998, unless you liked Strangers in Paradise or you wanted to read comics that were really specifically coded for men, and not even boys, but like middle-aged men. And, some people really like that stuff, and that's great. Like, people love the X-Men. People find the stuff they need to with Teen Titans or what have you. But, yeah, all of a sudden it was here's a comic that is, unrepentantly pink. And there weren't even pink books that you could buy other than Sailor Moon as a comic retailer. So for me, I was so excited, yeah.
And I think there are quite a number of men who are into Sailor Moon as well, too. Right?
Yeah. I always felt like you were saying that it was sort of a separate thing. It feels like a tokusatsu show to me. It feels like Power Rangers, where you've got sort of everyone's got a color, everyone's got a deal, everyone's got a personality trait that's defined by their astrological symbol. Everyone's got power ups. Like if they had a Zord, we'd be set. That'd be amazing. Actually, a Sailor Moon Zord would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Well, I mentioned Cardcaptor Sakura, and Clamp was specifically brought into Nakayoshi, and they were scouted by the same person who edited Sailor Moon.
Oh wow! Okay.
They wanted another Sailor Moon. And this is what they got was Magic Knight Rare Earth, which is
that's different.
A little bit more. But Rare Earth also was the idea of why can't girls pilot Mecha? So, sure, this will be more stylish.
Yeah.
I meant to remind you that everyone that Cardcaptor Sakura is available from Dark Horse Manga.
It is.
And there'll be a new version, a new sequel to Cardcaptor Sakura called Cardcaptor Sakura Clear Card. They'll be coming out from Kodansha Comics, I believe, next year. Mm. Or is it later this year? I forget. There's also a new edition of Sailor Moon, in case you don't have any of the other two editions. It's bigger and more beautiful. Go pre-order it now. I want to say a little bit about the aesthetics of Sailor Moon. And I came late to the Sailor Moon party. I had actually picked up a couple of the paperbacks at a garage sale and gave them to my kids, which I think is what got them. It was the worst bargain I ever got. Because I got five for a dollar, and then I got to spend thousands of dollars on manga. After my kids, look, Bruce Basket,
Gateway drugs, man.
Totally. Totally. It's like the goldfish that I won. Looks like you can talk about that. Anyway, so with Sailor Moon, I remember looking at it and going, God, this is so cluttered. There's stuff all over the place. It's almost hard to decode the panels, especially in those little Tokyopop paperbacks. And then I looked at my children's binders, and there's stickers all over. And I realized, I'm thinking like an adult. I would also say, oh yeah, MySpace, it's so busy, I can't find anything, and my kids are like, mom. So I think that Sailor Moon, it's girly, not just because there's a girl in it, but also because that really reflects, I think, the way that girls put these all over your locker kind of thing.
So Chris, you said something very interesting.
Did I?
You sent this what? You sent this.
Oh, thing. Yeah.
Oh,
this is...
Please explain.
This was a fun thing. Isagi, let's get on that thing and get out of here. I don't know how to pilot a boat. Then why don't you turn into a sailor? All right. I saw this yesterday. I was cracking. cracking up, and I'm like, oh, I've got to get this on the panel. But it's really funny because literally she is a sailor, and theoretically she turns into Sailor Moon, pilots the boat, steals the boat, and drives away. Floats away. But beyond that, there's this expectation, especially in comics for girls, that like you can transform yourself to literally accomplish anything. And I'm finding it, it's that we would think of it as like the shonen spirit. When we think about shonen stuff, it's like literally any obstacle that's going to be put in front of somebody, they're going to overcome, unless they're Ashton Ojo. And then they're going to die.
Spoilers.
But like literally anything that's put in front of a shonen, like a boy action hero, he's going to overcome. That's how those comics work. But for girls, like the idea of that transformation into being hyper-competent, no matter how ridiculous or wonderful the situation is something that you just don't always see in a lot of media.
I got to push back on that a little bit, because back in the 80s, I went to, Mattel had like a big Barbie thing, and there I went to a huge Barbie party, Andy Warhol was there, and the theme...
Oh my God.
And I still have... Yeah. Okay. New York in the 80s, man.
Can you do an imitation of him when he's like...
It was a different time. Was We Girls Can Do Anything. I mean, that was like Barbie's motto for a long time, was We Girls Can Do Anything. And there was like the Barbie astronaut and the Barbie, I don't know, she could glow in the dark too. But like the whole, you know, Barbie is a persona who can become whatever she wants to become.
I've got a question for the audience. How many of y'all watched Sailor Moon on TV when you were kids, like mid-90s? Oh, yeah, so case in point.
Wow, yeah.
So that was the same era as the X-Men cartoon, Spider-Man, there was like a weird Silver Surfer. But like what Toonami did that was genius was they put Sailor Moon next to Thundercats, to Robotech, to all these really diverse shows. So I get home from school, first thing on Sailor Moon, yes, I'm watching that, because Robotech is next, so that's like 2 hours, or I guess 1 hour, 40 minutes of great action, whether it's fighting or robots. And I think that it's a bigger part of our culture than we realize.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because like 90s cartoons were fundamental to pretty much everything that's a movie right now.
Like if you track it back.
Yeah. Exactly.
One thing I like about Magical Girls, and it suggests the idea of the liberation of style and aesthetics in superhero. You stop to think about it, there's no logical reason why superheroes dress the way they do. First of all, why are they all so ripped? It doesn't matter how good your physique is, you can't lift a battleship over your head the way a superhero can. They should just look like ordinary people. So, you know, Magical Girls, they dress however they want. Well, not however they want, but, you know, there's no... If you have superhuman powers, just dress the way you want. Look cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. I actually, when I was a kid, I always thought that Kate had something to do with why Superman could fly.
Me too.
Yeah. So.
Well, Joe Madureira, he did books for Image, didn't he?
Battle Chasers. He was big on Uncanny X-Men as well.
He talked to me about how Giant Robo, the anime, changed his thoughts about superheroes. And he liked the fact these guys were all wearing funky old Chinese robes or like suits. And they all were, like, completely powerful. And it's like, yeah, your powers and the way you look, they don't have anything to do with each other. And he liked the idea that, like, Marvel always had this very powerful idea of explaining everything. But he liked the idea of not explaining anything at all. Like, if you need to throw axes out of your wrists, like, on 80 feet of chain, just do it, man.
Yeah, just practice.
I'm going to go a little faster. So this is another it's called Tiger and Bunny. Which is probably the most unsuperhero names for superheroes, but...
That's the point, isn't it?
I guess, maybe. Andy, would you care to explain this series?
Sure. The concept behind it is kind of corporate-sponsored heroes, and the heroes also kind of have to, like, vie for popularity and points.
It's kind of like NASCAR.
It's a reality show. Yeah.
And that's the basic concept behind the story.
I feel like Tiger and Bunny was not just created with male fans in mind, but female fans.
Well, sure, and he's worried about being replaced by a younger, handsomer guy, right?
Yeah, and the roots of the story, it's by Katsuna, right? And so he did a lot of the character designs.
The video real eye.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which is also available from Disney. Not the manga, I'm sorry.
So one of the things I like about Tiger and Bunny that you see that you... don't see as much in American comics. I mean, actually, Tiger and Bunny is hilarious. And I'm not a huge superhero fan, but I love this. Is that you also see them, like, when they're done, you know, when they kind of go off the clock, and they're, like, working out in the gym together and stuff. So you see them take off their costumes and become regular people. And it just really, it really works. But yeah, I mean, again, Tiger and Bunny, Bunny's not happy with his superhero name. And there's the older guy and the younger guy working together, and they don't like each other, so you get that tension. And also, they have weirdly limited powers. I think one of them can only be strong for 5 minutes or something. So again, you have them working with the limitations. And then everybody has a catchphrase, and like they're all trying to, they compete in this reality show where you get a certain number of points for being first and a certain number of points for making an arrest, and you know, you get points for these different things. And then there's also so popularity, so everybody has a special gimmick, and the girls all hate theirs. They're being forced to do things. Like there's one who wants to be a singer, but she has to do this instead. I think she's the ice one.
Yeah.
And then everybody has a motto as well. So
and
it's
sponsorships too.
And sponsorships.
That's what you're not seeing on this, is that in the anime they all have logos on them like NASCAR drivers.
Yeah. They made like a real Pepsi Blue or something ad with Yes, so you got it, with Blue Rose. Like, so it's this weird mix of, it exists as a comic, like that's fine, but then it's also brought into real life as if it were a real thing, like she were a real person.
And for superhero fans in America who should check it out, it's almost a meta metaphor for how what's happened to superheroes, how they've been absorbed into big entertainment conglomerates, mm-hmm. how we're constantly getting movies and TV.
Disney and Warner Brothers own your favorite heroes, and that's
wild. I
also
think though, if I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, go.
When you look at like, athletes and stuff today, even like snowboarders and skiers and things. When, you know, like I'm not sure if you all know this, but when skiers, they always like pop up their skis, and then if you see the brand name of their skis, and they get like $100 or something. I just made up that figure, but it's like that's part how their sponsorship works, and so it's exactly like this.
Yeah, it's pretty realistic in that sense.
Similarly, other sponsors, it's One Punch Man.
Can everybody in the room who's wearing One Punch Man shirts or costumes, like, raise their hand?
Yeah! Like, I can explain One Punch Man.
So, I guess Andy might have seniority, but I've been trying to get people to read this book for, like, 4 years since it started being in Jump. It's just, imagine being the strongest guy in the world. You can beat anybody, you can do anything, but all you want is like a good fight, like you want to go the distance, you want to have like a close finish, but you can't because you worked out too hard, and now you're bald, and One Punch kills everything. And that's it. Like, it sounds, like people describe it as a parody or a satire, but it's not. It's just a funny superhero comic. Like, it's so loving to the genre.
Yeah.
And the characters, like, they believe in what they're doing, and it's one of my favorite comics. Like, it's
you actually
wild.
Convinced me to read it, because it was Jump only, and they weren't print copies, so yeah. I don't really like reading online, but I've changed. I got a subscription to Shonen Jump and checked it out. It was so good.
Yeah, I'm the kind of guy that cries at Shonen manga, so this is...
I'd actually disagree a little bit with David. I'd say that One Punch Man is the kind of comic that is both a parody and very serious about itself, and one of the reasons is that the art is really good, and now I'm blanking on the artist's name.
Yusuke Murata.
Yes, Yusuke Murata, who did Ice Age 21. So the art is actually fantastic, but the stories it's illustrating are ridiculous. And particularly, well, so the villains are really kind of over the top. You know, there's like the crab, the person who ate too much crab and became a crab.
They're like the Tokusatsu village from like...
Yeah, they totally are.
But the superhero, so again, you have this kind of corporate structure where there's like a superhero guild, and there's levels, and there's like an S2 and stuff like that, And this allows Murata to bring in a ton of side superheroes, who again are very specific and very ridiculous. My favorite is Pineapple Man, who wears two giant canned pineapple rings on his shoulders. I'm not even sure what his superpower is. I don't know.
Smelling wonderful.
Maybe he keeps jungle from setting or something.
I wish you told me about that, because I would have loved to have had a picture of Pineapple Man up there.
Yeah. Why does nobody cosplay Pineapple Man? And then
he could be sponsored by Dole.
One recent volume, they actually get into a mixed martial arts tournament, which gives One and Murata the opportunity to just do like page after page of really ridiculous. It's like wrestlers, like professional wrestlers, but Japanese and even weirder. So they're just having so much fun with this comic.
Do you have a favorite One Punch Man?
My favorite character is probably Moon Man Rider.
Yes.
That's true, and here he is.
This
oh, yeah,
here
he is. because he's just like he's got heart, you know. He doesn't have a lot of power. He rides a bike. I love bikes.
Yeah, like his power is having a bicycle.
Exactly.
He does heart.
Yeah.
He does. Yeah.
Ah, it's so good.
I wanted to explain a little bit. 4 years ago, it was, mm-hmm. I think, when we started serializing it. It comes from a Young Jump website, where it's originally published. And, you know, we do a weekly Shonen Jump. And one of my editors on staff, he said, hey, a friend told me you're going to read this. And so I checked it out, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing! And I talked to my Japanese counterparts at Shueisha, and I said, hey, can we do this even if it's not like part of Jump? And he was like, he's like, okay, maybe. And he's like, let me go read it. And then he read it, and the next week when we Skyped, he said, that's amazing, you have to do it!
And in fact, one question I had sort of made history because it was the first manga to be nominated for an Eisner Award when it was still digital only. It wasn't out in print. Yeah, it wasn't out in print when it was nominated for an Eisner Award.
And we were focusing on the manga too, but I think, I mean, most of you have probably seen the anime if you've seen the manga as well. And I was in Japan and I was having breakfast with my friend's kids who are in Japan, and I was like, oh, I got a new job, I'm working for a manga publisher. And they're like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, do you guys know Naruto? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, do you guys know Dragon Ball? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, One Punch Man? Oh my god, One Punch Man! Like, they just lost it. And I was like, and My Hero Academia? And then they were just, like, vibrating in their seats. So, yeah, it is amazing to see. It really is like One Punch Man. Like he's in a different comic than the rest of the people who were in the comic around him, especially in the early chapters.
Yes.
Because he's just, like, he has that ridiculous, like, underdrawn face. And everyone else around him is so cool and getting beat up and trying so hard. And he's just like... I can't believe how popular that became, because I liked it, and I was worried that because I liked it, and because it was so weird, we would never see it again.
I can't believe you think this would be like a one-joke manga, right? Like, you'll get one episode, maybe one volume out of it, and then you're done, but it's like, I don't know what volume. What volume is it up to, Andy?
8 or 9?
No, teens. More than that. Yeah, oh, it's in the teens. Because I review it regularly for... Barnes & Noble. And in a way, it's like, it's the Superman problem. Like, any good Superman adventure involves kryptonite in some way, because if Superman is so strong, then he's like One Punch Man. And One Punch Man kind of just carries that to its extreme. And eventually, you know, no matter what happens, and there are these epic battles that go on for chapters, and then One Punch Man just comes in and goes, I'm bored. He sets down his groceries and boom. You know? That's that.
He's annoyed by having to be superhero.
Yeah,
like, he doesn't like the bureaucracy. He just wants to, like, have fun and be a hero. But... it's totally... One Punch Man is definitely a one-joke comic, but that one joke is so good. Like, it's the one punch of jokes, basically. Like,
there's, the one punchline, man?
There we go.
Maybe manga reminding us of something we've lost in our own superheroes. Frank Miller once said that the best and the worst thing to happen to comics in his lifetime were the same thing. He said the inmates took over the asylum. Mm-hmm. It meant people like him.
Yeah.
People who had grown up drawing comics, and now that they were adults, they went through serious comics. But you go back and look at the old Supermans, you know, they'd have these issue after issue of these convoluted plots of trying to make Lois Lane think that he and Clark Kent are not the same person. This is the most powerful person on Earth, is wasting his time with this nonsense. And they had all these, like, weird, absurdist, you know, and Superman would play these cool pranks on all of his friends. You know, that's what I kind of get reminded of when I see these absurd things
Totally.
Like One Punch Man. We used to be like that, too. And maybe we should... you know, relax a little bit and go back to some of that.
Yeah, one of the best jokes in One Punch Man is a throwaway panel. He's climbing some mountain to go fight some dude, and there's a sign that says bear crossing, and there's a knocked out bear under it. Like, you know, you put it together, and you're like, this is so dumb, but it's so good.
Speaking of fresh and fun, My Hero Academia. So we were talking about this a little bit early, but this is a... you sent this, David, this picture of a cast.
Oh, shoot, I did send that. This is something I love that manga does that American comics don't do enough. This is, like, pretty much just the realm of fan art, where they take the characters, they either dress them up in a new setting, or they just, like, show you what they look like in street clothes, or, like, gimmick clothes. So there's, like, the winter chapter. This one, I think this was the winter bits, since there's Todoroki in that amazing sweater. this is kind of what Carl was getting at, where it didn't used to be, like, superheroes don't have to be serious. You can do realistic stories, you can do, like, emotionally devastating stories with superheroes. You can also do this, where it's like, oh, these are characters that have their own taste in things. Like, some like ruffled collars, some just wear, you know, a blazer. Again, Bakugo is the best, because he clearly does not want to be there. And, like, it comes across in the art, like, the attitude is there. This is still storytelling. Like, you're still learning about the characters from this. And it's just from, like, a popularity poll, I think, did this art for.
Mm. I like that you can look at these characters, and just from their facial expressions, you can see their personalities. And even the characters that have the latest powers, like that kid who can pull balls off his head and throw sticky things. People still like him.
Do people like him?
No.
People super hate him. Someone was like, oh, if Ranma came out now and Hokusai, I don't know if we could actually deal with that character at all. I'm like, we have that character. He's awful.
People like Mineta, really like him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's true.
And it's great when, like, he gets fired up about being a hero and, like, he contributes in his small, like, not great way.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Can someone summarize the story of My Hero Academia for the audience?
Do you guys know X-Men? Imagine if X-Men was, I guess it is a franchise. Imagine that if the X-Men University had several different schools and everybody gets a superpower, everybody goes to hero school. They decide, like, your role, you get an internship with another hero, so you learn how to be a hero. It's like the New Mutants, but, like, super bureaucratized, if that's a word.
Japanese.
Also that everyone in this world has a power of some sort, whether it's insignificant or something, and then the main character is one of the rare people who grew up without one, mm-hmm. even though he worships heroes.
And studied very, very hard. Yeah. He has a notebook with all the information in it.
It's kind of creepy.
That's so Shonen.
But he ends up getting the powers of the mightiest superhero called All Might, who is the guy with the weird hair.
My favorite little detail in the first couple volumes was they're sitting down, they're talking about how he's never gonna have a quirk, he's never gonna have a superpower. And it's like, but ma'am, like, he's talking about his mom, but you have a superpower. It's like, yes, I can pull small objects towards me, and it's just like, that's her power. And it was like such a throwaway moment, but it just defined that entire world to me, because you're like, oh, 80% of people have superpowers. And you're like, that would be insane. Like, we would just blow everything up all the time. It's like, well, no, I mean, I can refill water. That's all I got. I'm going to be an amazing waiter.
The crisp 62 degrees.
Yeah, crisp all time. Yeah. And that was, I thought, such a, like, an amazing piece of world building that was, like, half a panel.
Yeah.
And so smart and so considered. And that is all the way through this series.
He's
all these little
smart
moments.
Series, yeah.
He's really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't believe this is only his third series, too, because it seems so accomplished. That's, it's really great.
It also makes you realize how greedy we can be in our superhero writing. If you stop to think about it, the ability to pull a glass of water towards yourself is just as miraculous as the ability to collapse a building with your mind. Either way, it's impossible.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I mean,
true.
Just the ability to do something as superhuman, you should be able to write something with that instead of saying, oh, no, this person has to have energy powers or so forth. It goes back to the idea of... we were talking earlier about not doing what you're expected to with your powers. Mm-hmm. You know, writing. You think he's going to do this, but then just because you have a power doesn't mean you have to use it in a fight. It might be more intelligent not to use it.
In the 70s, everyone thought Ray Geller was kind of cool. He could bend a spoon, but that's not actually practical.
I think the Japanese believe that, actually.
Ray Geller was a big thing in Japan.
There's a bit in Naruto that kind of gets that kind of the mundanity of superpowers, where... there's a whole ninja family in Konohagakure who just, like, they can control wood, so they do all the building. So when this city gets wiped out, they call them in, and they have to do all this hard labor for no reason, because that's their ninja magic. And that kind of sucks.
Is this series popular in Japan as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's one of the top Jump series right now. So.
So popular is getting spin-offs that you can get for free. There we go.
So, yeah, we're starting August 7th. We're going to start putting out 3 chapters of the spin-off series, My Hero Academia Vigilantes. And it's right along in there in the My Hero Academia world. The main character, his power is when 3 of his limbs is in contact with the surface, he can go really fast. But that fast, the speed is like about how fast you can go on a bicycle. And so that's the main character's power. He is not a sanctioned hero, so he's doing these heroic acts unsanctioned, and he teams up with a girl who her power is that she can hop really high, and she likes to do gorilla pop idol performances. And the third character, he's just kind of like a brawler guy. And his name is Knuckle Duster.
That's a good nickname.
That's
yeah.
a take. Right.
You have a question?
Come up to the mic, please. So let's. We have a few moments for Q&A. Let's give it a shot.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, this is particularly about My Hero Academia. When people have asked me about this particular manga / anime, I've always said, well, just imagine the X-Men matched up with One Piece. And we've seen the development in shonen anime and manga from Dragon Ball all the way through the Naruto series to One Piece. Have you seen any of that transfer to comics? Because we've seen a lot of like American superheroes make it into manga recently with things like My Hero Academia and One Punch Man. How much of that shonen-esque anime quality, as it were, have you seen show up in American comic books, particularly larger scale ones like the X-Men or...
Not enough is the only answer to that question.
Not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
if Batman were a manga, you know, he should make friends with the Joker by now, and now they
teamed up to fight a bigger...
I did a really bad job of managing the time, but we are out of time.
We're sorry.
We had fun, though.
In the meantime, there's a bunch of manga publishers on the exhibit hall. Please go visit them and buy lots of manga. And there are more panels this weekend, so please check them out.
You know how it's very common.
Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Thank you so much.